This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Michael Muhammad Knight grew up in an Irish Catholic family in upstate New York. But as a teenager, he found himself at a crossroads. He was either going to continue writing letters to Charles Manson or devote his time to studying Islam. He chose the latter, and that decision changed the course of his life. 1 year later, he had officially converted to Islam, spent 2 months studying the religion in Pakistan. Michael is now a prolific and published writer who has documented his evolving religious beliefs in novels, memoirs, and essays. He is also a well-known provocateur, famous for prickling the traditionalists. His new book, Why I Am a Salafi, continues in that trend. It's an attempt to confront the roots of Islamic fundamentalism and question the possibility of any pure religion. Michael Muhammad Knight is a PhD candidate in Islamic studies at UNC Chapel Hill and joins me now in our studio. Michael, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to those teenage days when you were casting about and tell us how you came to Islam.
Yeah, well, I was a mixed up kid a little bit. I mean, the Manson thing, I guess, is a great introduction to that. I was actually fascinated with Charles Manson because that was how my mom explained my dad to me. My dad actually practiced Manson eyes in the mirror and was violent and abusive and
moved toward white supremacy and ultranationalism.
The only reason I wouldn't call him a neo-Nazi is because he didn't like groups and organizations. He was kind of a loner on a mountain by himself. Son of a Pentecostal preacher who had, it was one couple, 20 kids. He was the 13th. And he was a rough person. And when I was 12 or 13, I had no idea who he was, but my mom started telling me these stories. And Charles Manson was just the way that she contextualized it for me, that he was kind of an aspiring Manson. When I was around that same age, I had a stepdad, and my stepdad hated the fact that I listened to MC Hammer, to date myself a little bit. And when I learned that black culture, if you can call MC Hammer black culture, was scary and threatening to my dad in rural, red state part of New York, I graduated from that to Public Enemy, and I graduated from Public Enemy to Malcolm X. And what was my teen rebellion and an expression of my angst eventually led to something more spiritually serious and also more politically serious.
How did that happen? How did you go from that kind of political identity to a religious form in Islam?
Well, it went from using Public Enemy, at the time I saw this as an insincere thing. This is more of a retrospective judgment, but using Public Enemy to alienate my stepdad and my whole town, pretty much, to finally reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, which I guess was inevitable, and reading Malcolm's transformation, the way that the search for knowledge and truth and his own origins had transformed him and taken him from, kind of like below the prison, not just in the prison, but under the prison, to become the global leader of freedom struggle that he became. And seeing the role of Islam in that, I think naturally led me to consider Islam.
So then you studied, you converted to Islam, and you went to Pakistan.
Yeah, so I took time before actually converting to learn the prayers in Arabic, to get what I consider to be a decent foothold in Muslim belief and practice. And then my mom drove me 45 minutes to the mosque, witnessed my shahada or my conversion. And the mosque where I converted was connected to teachers at Faisal Mosque, which was an enormous mosque, one of the largest in the world, built in Islamabad as a gift from the King of Saudi Arabia to the people of Pakistan. And the opportunity came to spend 2 months of my senior year, which I was happy to do, basically living in the mosque and studying.
How did your understanding, or did your understanding of Islam change in that experience?
In the moment, it was great. I loved it. It was a beautiful time. I still look back at it fondly, as much as things have changed. But what I didn't get in that time was the sense of Islam as rooted in history and subject to history. So Islam, as I was taught it, amounted to basically an abstracted, decontextualized set of bullet points. This is what Islam says. This is what Islam does. And there was no sense of disagreement between Muslims. Mm. So, for example, I was there for 2 months learning Muslim history and never heard the word Shia. They just didn't exist. And I had this monolithic, absolute
instruction of Islam.
As a Sunni. And I just took Sunni Islam to be generic, universal Islam. So I didn't get that sense of multiplicity and diversity and things that now I celebrate. And that's basically how I preserve myself as a Muslim, is to be aware of those multiplicities. At the time, it was this is Islam and you take it or leave it.
Well, so and also in that abstract form, you can then understand the kind of pure the theory, at least in that one sect. Ultimately, religions are grounded in a history, in a context, and that always leads to the question of how much is religion a kind of identity, a thing that humans need. We need to identify with some group who has this core set of beliefs, and how much of it is this kind of transcendental truth.
Absolutely. A big part of my conversion was how I socially defined myself and where I located myself in society. So if my exposure to Public Enemy led me to really think about racism, and my exposure to Malcolm X led me to implicate American Christianity in that racism, becoming Muslim, as much as it was a theological position, it was just as much about how I located myself in the world as a body interacting with other bodies.
When did that observation occur to you, that that's what was going on?
I think it was largely retrospective. Mm-hmm. I mean, I converted about 20 years ago, and it's more looking back. I mean, at the time when I first found Islam, I was actually an atheist, and I wasn't searching for God. I wasn't searching for the meaning of life in this world. I was looking for a way to reconstruct myself, and that was inseparable from the politics, was inseparable from the social positioning.
But ultimately, I mean, this is the thing we all have to grapple with, that you can easily see how Christianity as a form, as a political form, has done enormous damage. It's responsible for colonialism, for much of the damage in North America and the post-colonial world. And so people blame Christianity. Founder of Christianity famously said, love your neighbor as yourself, turn the other cheek. And so, again, we're all – and the same for Islam. People who claim to speak for the Islamic world do unspeakable things, and then we can hear on various TV networks that they're responsible for all of our pain.
Sure. And you know, there's competing narratives of either, you know, Islam is responsible single-handedly for so much destruction and chaos, or Islam is what created civilization in a particular part of the world and gave new freedoms and gave new rights and sparked the intellect and all of this. And you know, part of the process of this book was really thinking about a decentered Islam, you know, a decentered idea of religion altogether, in which it's not that religion is the singular driving force, that we make it as much as we are made by it.
When you grappled, your first novel, I think, grappled with this question of multiplicity. I mean, how did you see Islam then sort of situated? As was Islam an exemplar of multiplicity? Could we look to Islam for ways in which religions can embrace a more open idea?
Well, there's the particular presentation of Islam that I was pushing against and that I've been pushing against for some years now, where there is just a singular unified voice, and a lot of people need that. But I think when we look within the historical richness of the tradition and just how diverse it was capable of being, and how many wildly disagreeing and rebellious voices there are, that's actually what keeps me in. And that's actually what reconciles me to communities and people who are much more conservative in a lot of ways than I am. But I look to the rebels and the misfits and claim that as part of Islamic tradition, too.
Well, tell us that this is your 11th book, Why I Am a Salafi. You should tell us perhaps what is a Salafi and how it, you know, where it is on a spectrum, if there is one in Islam.
Well, I would identify the Salafis as a very modern movement and very much a product of modernity. And they would find that objectionable and perhaps offensive, because the Salafi claim is to follow the first three generations of Muslims as authoritative sources of how to understand and practice Islam. The movement became very prolific in the 20th century, and you know, labels are messy, but you could call Salafism the official state ideology of contemporary Saudi Arabia, and Saudi's global influence makes a particular Salafism very influential. And there's tons of people who embrace aspects of Salafi ideology without putting that name on themselves. And there are many Salafis who would despise the term Salafi simply because when you create this new label, you're kind of denying their claim that this is just pure Islam in its original form.
This is what the critics of religion in general, though, point to as the problem with religion, that everybody gets to define themselves or their sect as the one true keeper of the real knowledge, and that these fights almost indicate, almost prove the absence of a divine presence, because who would allow such fighting in their name?
Sure. And, you know, when I can see that being troubling for a lot of people, you know, and a lot of people don't want there to be multiplicity in Islam because, like you said, you know, that threatens the transcendence. But within the tradition, we can also find people who celebrate that disagreement and say that, you know, the way that we read the Quran should be thinking about, like, how, you know, if William Shakespeare wrote his plays knowing the vast array of interpretations and the vast, you know, every book report that would ever be written, every film adaptation, every reference, if Shakespeare knew all of that when he was writing, how would we read Shakespeare? How do we think about him? And there are Muslim thinkers who say that about the Quran also.
And that in many ways, that's the value of these traditions, is that they're living, breathing traditions that can adapt to changing conditions and changing contexts.
Sure. You know, at this point, the historical instability is not a problem for me. I actually take a lot of comfort in it.
You write in your book, in your latest book, you refer to a Facebook group called Radical Muslims, and then they sort of put their manifesto up on Facebook. We believe the Prophet Muhammad was a radical feminist, environmental, anti-racist, community organizer, activist, and freedom fighter that believed in freeing people from the status quo and freeing them from oppression through Islam, and Allah, may his name be praised, and we believe in the following, in following that tradition.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a product at this point of 4 years of rigorous academic critical study of religion. So, and more than that, if I'm including my master's also. So there's a part of me that would intellectually problematize those claims. You know, how can someone be anti-racist before race existed as a concept? What's the 7th century term for feminist? And how would we say that Muhammad claimed to be one? All those kinds of things. And I can critique those and poke holes in it. So what's going to resonate with me personally as a human being who lives in the world and me as an academic who is, you know, walled off from the world and detached from it, those are two different things. But yeah, that power to creatively reimagine Muhammad and what he did and what he represents, that offers a lot to me personally.
So that you can really understand that if you're trying to in any way grasp a transcendental or experience that which is transcendent, you'd have to expect that when it's embodied, it's going to look and feel different, right? Those are two precisely different things, and so therefore it ought to be different. There better be some kind of conflict. On the other hand, how do you then prevent a sort of relativism that allows me to make my religion into whatever's comfortable for me?
You know, a lot of the time when I have these kinds of conversations with my co-religionists, I will be confronted with that critique. Well, you're just saying Islam is whatever we say it is. The buffet always gets used. You know, you're treating Islam as a buffet where you can choose what you want. And I've even seen in academic circles some people responding to my work in that way, that I reduce Islam to whatever we want it to be at a given moment. For me, that's not a problem. So a lot of times people come to me with that critique as though that shuts down the conversation and I must answer their theological need for an absolute transcendent message that none of us can negotiate with. And I can't offer that to them. So I say, you know, I'm sorry if that's a problem for you. You have to figure that out yourself because I'm not a prophet and I can't speak in these transcendent terms. I can't speak without interpretation and I can't speak without interfering really with the content. And personally, you know, from where I stand in terms of male privilege, white privilege, American privilege, all these different things, it's important to recognize how historically specific I am, and that when I speak for Islam, I actually am making it up at that moment.
Well, how do other Muslims take your conversion and take you as a white guy from Rochester?
The conversion itself is great. I think if you look at American Muslim communities, you'll see that converts, and specifically white converts, occupy a much greater portion of the public voices than they actually represent numerically in the mosque. So there's a number of white converts who have become prominent leaders and thinkers in American Muslim communities. So the conversion itself, I mean, everyone loves when someone switches teams and says, I grew up with this, but I decided that your way is better. Mm. They love that. And, you know, as a teenager, I was told specifically that white converts were especially important because there is such a rich history of African-American conversion, but not the same for white converts. So white converts are prized. But for a lot of readers, I might be the wrong kind of convert, actually.
Michael Muhammad Knight is the writer in question. His new book is called Why I Am a Salafi. And Michael, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about him and about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. Our intern is Andrew Tai. Our news director is Brent Wolf. And North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.